Welcome to a spooktacular episode of Caged In, as ever brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, your crypt keeper for the evening, Petros Patsilivus. We're here to talk about Nicolas Cage's first foray into the world of horror. The 1988-89, well, maybe we'll get into when the fuck this film was released in this conversation. Vampire's Kiss, directed by Robert Bierman. And you could say this film is a horror, comedy, workplace drama. Again, something we will get into during this conversation. This film stars Nicolas Cage, Maria Conchita Alonso, Jennifer Bills, Cassie Lemons, and Elizabeth Ashley, based on a script by Joseph Minion. So joining me today is not one, but three fantastic guests of the ghoulish kind. First up, we have the Duke of Spook, Jonathan Foster. Next up is the Doc of Shock, David Rosen. And last, by no means least, is the undead, Daryl Edge. How are you, gentlemen?
Hello.
Hey, doing great.
I feel undead at the moment, so that's surprisingly apt. But otherwise, I'll die after Vampire's Kiss is done and not a second before.
That's good. That's kind of how the film ends.
I want someone to drive a stake into my torso at the moment, given how I'm feeling. But
I stole those nicknames from Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. They are two of the nicknames that they give to Death when he's introduced on stage at the end. And I felt like if I'd used the third one for you, Daryl, like it would have felt like a personal attack, because it is the man with no tan. And as a fair-skinned ginger gentleman, I feel like that would have been too much of a kind of assault on who you are as a person. So I opted for the undead, because it felt less personal.
There's a fine line between assault and facts, and you know, that's fine.
Amazing. So yeah, let's obviously, that was the voice of Daryl. Just so listeners can keep track of who is who, Jonathan, could you give us a little whisper of your voice?
Hi, my name is Jonathan Foster.
Hey, how's it going?
And David, let's hear those tones.
I was gonna wear my vampire teeth for this podcast, but I couldn't find them, so this, for everybody listening at home, this is what I sound like.
It might have been bad for the edit, though. Weird from the, you know, when he tried to call the doctor with his teeth in.
Please.
Do you have a cold? A cold? Yes. So let's start off. I'm going to ask you guys, we'll start with you, David. When did you first see Vampire's Kiss? Was it a lasting memory?
Believe it or not, it was just a few days ago.
Wow.
Isn't that insane? Because I've been a Nicolas Cage fan my whole life. I've seen these scenes a million times in various, you know, the YouTube compilations and stuff like that. Somehow never saw it. And I'm actually later today going to be guesting on a podcast talking about Once Bitten. And this was going to come up. And I was like, I might as well finally get around to Vampire's Kiss. And so I watched it. And then I saw that you were looking for guests. And I was like, hey, this works out.
Perfect. Perfect. We'll get into your opinions on the film, I'm sure, as we get into this conversation. But
sure,
we got fresh blood, as it were, to Vampire's Kiss. Daryl, what about yourself? Obviously, you've covered this on your podcast, Cage Rage, but had you seen it before covering it on that podcast?
Yeah, I had. And I think just bouncing off what David was saying, I think I saw it in like the classic Nicolas Cage losing his shit compilations.
Mm-hmm.
Before I was more au fait with Nicolas Cage and his work. So I had just seen this out of context at a young, impressionable age and thought, this is now going to shape my adult years as well as my teenage years. And it did. Watched it with friends maybe in 2009, 2010. And it was, you know, obviously we'll get into it, but at that point in my life, it was a fever dream of a film. It's an incredible film, and even for all your descriptions at the start, horror, comedy, workplace, drama, none of those describe what this film actually is. And I think I've now seen it. This is maybe the fourth time I've seen it, which is, some may say, two times too many, but I will watch it at least four more.
Yeah, this weirdly was a big, like, drinking beers with buddies, like, let's put on Vampire's Kiss movie for me, like, in my kind of late teens, early 20s. Like, we would just watch this on hard rotation. So, like, it's it feels like a weird one because it is, yeah, it's such a weird mix of what the fuck is it? And I think that is very much what the film has become to a lot of people. But what about you, Jonathan? Like, when did you first see it? Like, when, what were you, yeah, what was that like?
Yeah. To be honest, I probably saw this when I was a kid, and it would have been like, you know, I was way too young to even understand what the fuck was going on in it. But I hadn't seen it since. And so it's almost like it was the first time again, having seen it just the other night for this. And, you know, I guess, like, Dave, I saw your post and I was just like, oh, I've been meaning to give this a rewatch anyway. So I'll check it out and it'll be fun to jump on, have a catch up. But yeah, I mean, given the nature of my job, you know, I guess much like the other guys, like, you know, you see these clips and everything on YouTube and, you know, it's like stuff of legend, the Nick Cage stuff. But then also, like, given the nature of my job, if anybody out there has heard me on one of your episodes before, I've been a guest a couple of times. You know, I work at the Prince Charles Cinema and I do a lot of the PR marketing, which means I know many films via, like, GIF form, and this is one of them. So yeah, that's kind of like where my relationship with the film had been up to this point.
Well, this film is on the Mount Olympus, on like the Mount Rushmore of memeified movies, right? It's kind of like in GIFs. It's kind of like a wellspring of GIFs.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's kind of jump into the film itself. And who wants to dive on the stake of taking the plot synopsis of this film? Who wants to take that silver bullet?
So Nicolas Cage stars as Peter Lowe, a literary agent in a New York firm who is a bit of a weirdo in any way, but then one day gets assaulted and aroused by a bat before being bitten by a lady who may or may not be a vampire, and then goes through a slow, strange metamorphosis into a vampire, but also just weird and strange. And it is the most Nicolas Cage of the Nicolas Cage films.
Yeah.
That's about right.
Yeah, that's fair.
I'd say he, you know, ends up going from being on the top of, like, you know, a literary agency into homelessness as well. So.
Yeah, and one thing I want to do is for you guys to listen to this, because this is the trailer for the film. And kind of like cast your minds back, is if you can, to when you had not seen this film. Is this the film you watched?
How was your weekend?
It's all right, you know. There's nothing earth-shattering.
He was an ordinary guy.
Morning, everyone.
Morning.
Looking for an extraordinary love.
I'm Peter Lowe.
Rachel.
I brought this girl up to my place the other night.
It started with a kiss.
Really hot.
A very special kiss.
You wanted her very badly.
Yeah.
A kiss that could drive you mad.
I hate interrupted love affairs, don't you?
Yep.
It's affecting his work.
There you are!
It's a horrible, horrible job. And you have to do it.
It's ruining his appetite.
My next appointment with you is Tuesday afternoon.
I'd like to make it sooner.
It's spoiling his sleep.
Sooner.
And don't think people haven't noticed.
Am I getting through to you, Alva?
He is so eccentric.
My.
For Peter Lowe.
Sooner.
That's just love.
Love?
Love.
In the big city.
Yeah! Don't laugh.
I'm a professional. I don't lie.
I'm a vampire! I'm a vampire! I'm a vampire!
Nicolas Cage.
The tortures of the damned!
Maria Conchita Alonso.
Shoot. Do it or I'll fire you. Do you understand? Not the floor, Alva.
And Jennifer Beals.
You are so pathetic.
Vampire's Kiss.
Strange stuff. I'll never do that again. Jeez.
So, what do we make of that? Is that the film we all watched?
No.
Yeah, that's just feels like some bizarre 80s rom-com that like makes it feel like it's a little more happy-go-lucky than it actually is.
that feels like that video that's like a fake trailer for The Shining where they turn it into a rom-com.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
That's what that feels like.
Yeah, though that is the genuine article original trailer for this film. And it makes it feel like I know a film that you've discussed on the Podchar Cinecast, John, is Teen Wolf. You discussed that on the podcast just last week. It makes it feel like that kind of film, don't you think? As opposed to I don't know. Who wants to take a stab at like what genre this is? I know that's kind of hard. Like Daryl tried to give us a plot, but what genre is this, David? What kind of, if you had to pigeonhole this, what would you say it is?
That's a really difficult question. I mean, dark comedy is the closest thing I could think of, but like very pitch dark because, I mean, you know, we'll get into it later, but I mean, it gets into a lot of different themes about, you know, toxic people and toxic bosses and workplace issues. And it's not just a vampire movie. It's not necessarily a comedy, and it's not a horror movie, really. It's just more of like just a really weird, fucked up dark comedy.
Absolutely.
Is that the type of thing you would go for normally, Jonathan?
I mean, to be honest, it was like right up my alley. I wasn't really sure like what I was going to expect from it, like, you know, given all the years of like just seeing the silly GIFs and all that, and you know, that can always sort of ruin a film or an experience for you if you feel like you're going in with some sort of expectations. But it kind of really surprised me in ways. Of course, it's like silly and is goofy, and there's stuff going on in it that I'm sure we'll get into that just doesn't really make sense. But at the same time, it like kind of shocked me of like how, like, I don't know. Yeah, like it's really existential and weird, and like there's a lot going on in it. And Cage is giving such a weird performance that on the surface, if you're like looking for the funny bits, then it's like, of course, it's funny and it seems goofy and you can't really describe what he's doing. But then when you like kind of really sit back and like kind of go with it, if you don't you know, put up too many barriers, then like you really start to see that he is like doing something actually kind of magical on screen, and it doesn't make sense. And I don't think he gets enough credit for that film, because like it shouldn't just sit as this like, hey, it's a gif, oh hey, it's funny, oh hey, it's the guy running around screaming I'm a vampire in the streets. Yeah, that shit's funny, but like he's actually doing something kind of incredible underneath it.
Yeah, he said in like a GQ like piece, I think they did like a video series where they kind of get talent to like go through their work and like pick out their favorites. And he's always said this was like his testing ground for his like nouveau shamanic way of acting, and has like cited it as being like his favorite film he's ever done. Because I know, like, with The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent,
I believe that.
He says that, like, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari is his favorite film. And I think in real life, it actually is. And it's like, this is German expressionism. German has even got, like, a moment where he's watching Nosferatu, and then there's scenes where he's kind of moving about the club like Nosferatu. People can't see him actually
totally
doing that.
He totally pulls the Count Orlok sort of thing out. Like, and even some of the shots and stuff. That they use in the film, like, just feel like they're riffing on Nosferatu. So
you get the feeling that the character that he's playing knows those characters and knows those movies, and maybe is drawing from some of that in what he's doing as he's starting to lose his mind. That's what I felt anyway.
Yeah, I feel like it's also he's like early in his career and he hasn't quite figured it all out yet, like what he actually wants to do. And he was like obviously testing some boundaries. And it kind of was a playing field. Like I read that he also had said something. It was like for his like stepping grounds into like, cause he, you know, he's on the precipice of like, you know, actually making it like big in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And he kind of had a little more free rein to get away with what he wanted to, because there's not really that many people properly in charge on set here. And he's like, you know, able to just kind of like, you know, just do whatever, not whatever he wants to, but like kind of like just explore his mm-hmm. creativity. And I believe he was saying that he had like was using it as a way to like test how he would move into the bigger budget studio yeah. pictures and how he would deal with that. So.
It's really fascinating to look at the timeline of this, because this would have been, it was actually shot in 1986 and kind of just like sat on the shelf for a bit. So like that year, you can only imagine like the three performances he possibly would have done like in a row would have been this, Moonstruck and Raising Arizona, which I think are kind yeah. of like the three of the cornerstones to kind of give us who Cage is moving forward. Like it's kind of
sure.
him. Yeah, kind of flexing these different muscles. And it's this one kind of, I don't know, feels like it's lost in the shuffle in regards to the way that it's perceived by audiences, especially. And I always think like the way that people lambast this movie, but hold like American Psycho up to be like this. And it's basically the same movie, right?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I was sitting there watching it just thinking that Peter Lowe was totally like just a, you know, an associate mm-hmm. of like, you know, Patrick Bateman. You know, he's like totally in the same circles and they probably are giving each other tips of like the best way to like murder some poor woman.
Well, you
get that scene with the XX was just like one business card discussion away from going full American Psycho.
When they're all talking to each other and like kind of like patting Peter on the back for like, and then you chased her into the bathroom, you sick dog, like, and all like laughing about it. It's like that is like, if that's not the pitchest of black comedies, then like then this is the darkest film ever made. Like they're kind of
I mean, I read something like Bret Easton Ellis had to have like, you know, caught a screening of this film before he was writing American Psycho, you know, like just like totally influenced by this. It's odd. I mean, you mentioned like the time period of when this came out. It kind of like freaked me out a bit when I was looking at the year, because I was like 89. That seems so odd in my head. Like this was like pre-Moonstruck, pre-Raising Arizona, which it technically was. But like, it actually wasn't released until after, and that kind of like seems so wrong. And maybe that also kind of has a bit of a problem with how the film was perceived by people who've seen Nicolas Cage play some relatively like safer and more critically acclaimed roles up to this point. And then you see that as like, whoa, that's a weird step back.
Yeah.
Like, they can't quite fathom what it is.
It's, you know? I think something like is I think it's Chris Hemsworth, like after he'd kind of broken into the MCU, all of a sudden they brought, I think it was like the Red Dawn remake off the shelf, and then like that movie was like filmed way before, and then there's like, oh, it feels like a different guy. Do you know what I mean? This is when he's like really fresh, like wet behind the gills, and it's like, yeah, like it's weird when that happens. How do you want to tackle this film? Obviously going beat by beat, guys, would be kind of drag. Let's open it out onto the floor and ask like some of the more memorable scenes for you. Obviously this film is immensely kind of broken out of context and clipped up the wazoo all over the place. But like, is there stuff that potentially isn't in those kind of clip reels that stands out to you? Daryl, what scenes kind of like spring to mind? And don't you goddamn say that alphabet scene. We'll get to that.
Well, obviously we're saying this is, I think this is kind of like the epitome of a film where it can be taken out of context and just memeified. And I think this film is maybe not solely responsible, but there's a lot of reasons why this film is maybe out of context responsible for the way that people think Nicolas Cage is as an actor. They sort of think his acting is this, because you just see Nicolas Cage losing his shit. And there are like huge exaggerated mannerisms, and we're talking about him stalking like Nosferatu through the nightclub. And like looking at some like stills of this as well in like black and white, I think Nicolas Cage, if he was an actor in the 30s, would have been like the biggest horror actor of all time if he was in the 30s.
Yeah.
No question in my mind. But I think when we're talking about Cage going the extra mile, if we can't talk about the alphabet scene, all right. I think the next one that comes to mind is sort of the cockroach scene in his apartment as well. Yeah. So I think it was something like the script called for him to like eat like a raw egg or something. Yeah. But then they found a cockroach and he ate a live cockroach that had to do two takes of it because they wanted something like memorable that was going to stick with the film. Because I think they said in commentary or what I've read online that if you think about it, the stakes of the film are actually quite low. It's just he's just harassing his assistant to find a contract for 2 hours of the film. And that's quite a low stake as far as films go. When you've got this, like, it's like every scene as the film progresses, there has to be something more unhinged about his character, even though he's a foul person. Let's not make any bones about it, because he's so, I don't even know what he is. It's so exaggerated and heightened and ridiculous. He kind of, I don't know if I'm terming something completely wrong here, like an almost like a Walter White effect, even though these are bad people, you go with them and you stick with it because there's something ridiculous and funny about him. And when he's eating that cockroach, it's like disgusting, but at the same time, you're like, oh, classic Peter Lowe.
Yeah. I think one of the more impressive things about that scene is that, like, I read that he was actually completely mortified by cockroaches, and it was sort of like a thing of him, I don't know, you know, want to throw a Joe Rogan reference out there, but going on Fear Factor on set before Fear Factor existed, and getting over his fear of the cockroaches for a ridiculous scene.
Yeah.
Like you said, it really does just show how much more unhinged he is at that point.
Well, he was like trying out a lot of stuff like in this, in regards to like when he wrecks that room, like when he's kind of absolutely losing his mind. They just let him, and like Robert Bierman is like, what? Like, I don't know why we actually let him do that, because it's like a massive kind of like insurance risk, like smashing mirrors and stuff like that. But the budget of this movie was what, $2 million, and I've got a little clip of Nicolas Cage talking about what he did with his share of his fee.
Also, because it was such a cheap movie, and I mean cheap, this movie cost under $2 million for everything. And I know you did it for an amazing fee.
Well, you know what I did? I did it for, it was $40,000, and I took that money and I bought my first sports car with it, and I still have it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, now, did
you buy?
I bought a 1967 427 Stingray Corvette.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, and I still have it, and the car is still worth the same amount it was then.
So, I want to ask you guys a question. To go around, Daryl, does Nicolas Cage, bearing in mind he has had some financial troubles, does he still own that car? Yes or no?
Does he still own that car? Yes or no? I feel like it's probably been seized in that time, but I'm going to say yes.
Jonathan, yes or no on the car?
I was just really distracted. He sounded really drunk in that clip. it's funny. I think it's probably like buried inside of his pyramid tomb.
And David, what do you reckon? What do you reckon?
Yeah, Cage? I'd like to hope it's an important one that he actually like held on to, but you know, who knows in that time frame when he was losing things.
Wow. Guys, I hate to break it to you. He said 1963, right? He didn't say 1964. 1963 was the year.
I think that's what he said.
I think so, yeah.
So yeah, it's here. So this Corvette was owned by Nicolas Cage until 2005. And then he made a profit. He made a profit on it. He made a profit on it, guys. It sold for $121,000. So he kind of took that 40 and
that was pretty good. Bad.
Tripled it, pretty much. He's done all right for himself.
And then he immediately bought like a dinosaur egg and lost it all.
Well, yeah. And 2005 as well. It's kind of even more heartbreaking because it's pre-financial woes. Do you know what I mean? This would have been like the height of Cage. This would have been like coming off the back of like Lord of War stepping into I don't know, maybe like National Treasure era. Do you know what I mean? He would have been on that Disney money. Oh, motherfucker. But yeah, there is an article on hotcars.com nicely titled, I guess very sympathetically titled Cars Nicolas Cage Owned Before He Went Broke.
Oh, heartbreaking.
I feel like
four of us should buy it back for him, I think.
Yeah, well,
this got to go fund me.
And this has kind of come to me just now. That feels like an episode in itself, just going through these cars. But I'm not going to take us down that rabbit hole because we'll be here all night.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that could be a whole new podcast for you. Once you get through all the Coppolas, you can just go through Nicolas Cage's financial history.
just reading out tax returns and every purchase he's ever made.
Caged In presents Coppola's Cars.
Caged In presents Cage's Taxes. There'll be a fallow period because I don't think he paid them for a few years. So there'll be a big old gap. Jonathan, what scenes stick out for you in this?
I mean, to be honest, any scene with Alva, like, because that really is just like the crux of the movie, isn't it? Like, and that's something I didn't really expect going into this, having like, you know, not seen it since I was a kid. And basically all I remembered from being a kid of this film was like, Nicolas Cage is a vampire. And I wasn't even really accurate on that. Like, and even living through GIFs, like when you try not to like look up, you know, what actually is going on, a full plot synopsis of a film, and you kind of go in cold on a film, like, you know, really surprised me how it was crazy. Like the whole Alva thing is funny. Like we were talking about Patrick Bateman and American Psycho. I mean, like that whole relationship really, you know, it just really feels like it could have been from that same story. Just like how, I mean, I particularly the worst scene is like when he's basically like he's been raking her over the coals over this stupid document, and he gets the phone call from the guy who basically, and we can hear it, we can hear that the guy basically is saying, oh, you know, that, you know, document you're looking for, I know you guys are busy and your girls, you know, are really busy, got better things to do, don't worry about it, don't worry about it. Meanwhile he's just like, uh-huh, you too. And then he gets off the phone. As you can see, I couldn't get a word in edgewise. You know, and it's just like, he's being such a dick. And then it just, how it escalates so far to like the point where he like apparently rapes her or whatever, which it's like, I wasn't expecting a rape turn in this film. But yeah, still like, you know, I have a bit of a joke anytime a film that is actually kind of good goes rapey, it's like it's rapey but kind of good, like, so that's kind of like where this film went, and it's kind of surprising. But yeah,
and there's that kind of, I don't know, awe-striking moment as well when she's like, are you gonna rape me? And he goes, yes, I am.
It's like what? Yeah, so fucking weird. Like, I mean, the good thing is he kind of gets his comeuppance, and it's not like, you know, it could be a dangerous line if people want to live this life, or like live this film through the life of like GIFs and memes and stuff, and don't actually sit down and watch it, you know, like, you know what I mean? Like, cause like, it's not like, he's not a hero. He's not a sympathetic character. He is a piece of shit. And I think, you know, if we view films that way, like particular, like, American Psycho or Fight Club. You know, I went through a whole history of going through these like very incel-esque films and stuff. Not that I'm saying Peter Lowe feels like an incel at all, but like that sort of style of man, toxic masculinity on screen and stuff. Like, you know, if people like are viewing these films and feeling so like, you know, wanting to like glorify the characters and all that stuff, but don't actually sit down and really watch what's going on in the film, then like that's a problem. And I hope more people stop living this film, like living through this film like a meme, and actually just watch it, you know.
Another movie that I watched for the first time just like recently, like a year or two ago, is Saturday Night Fever. And that's another movie where you're like, you just have no idea what's happening in that movie if you haven't seen it. You just, you get this idea of it that it's this fun loving movie, and these people are just awful. Like, they're just some of the worst people. And that's what's happening here. And if I could just jump right on top of what Jonathan's saying, because I was going to also answer that all the Alva scenes are like my favorite things about the movie. Like, you're getting this like incredibly toxic situation between boss and secretary, also between man and woman, between these two people, this power dynamic between them, and he is just absolutely taking it to the furthest possible limit. And you get the sense, like at least I did in my first watching of it, that you know, all the vampire stuff is almost superfluous. Like it could not even be happening, and it's still just a story of a guy going from bad to worse in the way that he's treating the people that are under him. And it just so happens he's also maybe turning into a vampire or just losing his mind, one or the other, but that's just all adding to it and turning him into an even bigger piece of shit. And watching that transformation, because Nicolas Cage is such an amazing actor, is, you know, just absolutely a joy to watch, even if it's also incredibly cringeworthy and just like awful.
Well, because you could like look at this film as, obviously we're seeing it almost through the prism of Peter Lowe's perspective, and there is like obviously like an allegory of this, and like you kind of take it away from that and like, well, how other people are seeing him, he's like an energy vampire, right? Because he's like just draining Alva's energy. Like when he kind of assaults that woman in the club, like does that happen, does it not, he kind of like really bums out the mood as well when he's like screaming at Jennifer Beals' character across the like dance floor and stuff like that. And he is just kind of like sucking the energy out of every room he's in. Like, you can imagine the, like thank God his therapist has got like a hunky boyfriend that she can go home to and like kind of like screw the night away, because otherwise she'd be at home going, fucking hell, I've got to see Peter on Tuesday afternoon. Do you know what I mean? The guy, the guy's such a, I know, drain on the energy.
There is that amazing moment though, when I think it's like the second time they have a meeting together, where he leaves and it's just camera leaves on her face, and she just kind of goes and just has this like look, and she just starts like biting on the tip of her pen or something, and it's just like, oh, that's beautiful. Like, am I wrong? Is that lady from Russian Doll? Like she's like the older sort of for Natasha Lyonne's character, sort of like the mother figure, although she's not her mother. I don't know if you guys have seen Russian Doll.
But I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
Been a bit, yeah.
It sounds like the same voice, because she kind of talks like this, you know. Well, I've been smoking since I came out the womb.
I think she's kind of the way into this movie as well, right? Because if you kind of like focus on her performance, it's like, oh, this is a comedy. Do you know what I mean? She's always, she's like the audience surrogate, like you said, in that moment where like we get her kind of like seeing how like absurd and pathetic Peter Lowe is. And it's like, I love those scenes with her, like especially the kind of climactic one where it's like Peter staring at a wall and like it's his fantasy version of it, and he's like, it's him like in her office, is him stood on the windowsill kind of with his steak, and then he's like, oh, the woman who comes in after you would be perfect for you, Peter. He's like, oh, Sandra, nice to meet you.
Yeah, it's just like, oh, by the way, like I raped Alva and I killed someone. It's like, go fall in love, Peter, go.
I felt like I should tell you.
Actually, I also I murdered a woman last night in a club.
Oh, don't worry about it, Peter. Yeah.
People get murdered all the time. Like, people die all the time.
It's New York City.
The session's over, Peter. Go fornicate. Get out of here.
Well, I want her movie. I want her kind of spin-off. Come on, stop giving us all these Disney Plus Marvel series. We want the week by week therapy cases from Peter Lowe's therapist from this movie.
You know what? That feels like that's never been done before. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, it's probably a bit fucked up, but at the same time, like, what television show these days isn't fucked up? But like a show that's just about a therapist who has fucked up clients in every episode, it's completely
Dr.
different.
Dr. Katz. That's the only thing I can think of.
Yeah. Is that a cartoon? Yeah.
That's a cartoon. Yeah.
In Treatment. Anyone see that? In Treatment sort of did.
I never watched that.
It was like a Monday to Friday thing, and each episode was a different client. And then Friday, it was the therapist seeing their therapist. But if we just do that, but with troubled Nicolas Cage characters.
Yeah. I mean, there was.
What about people becoming different kinds of monsters? That could be fun too.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Just a universal like monster series, but it's like each episode is a different therapy. One going to their therapist. Like,
there you go.
There we go.
Or it
could
just be like, it could just be the universal monster therapist. She has all of them as a client.
Yeah. Or they have a kind of AA style group. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
sure. Yeah.
All I want to do is suck the blood. Do you know what I mean? Like Frankenstein's monsters. They're like, do I exist? I don't know. I don't know why they all speak in a Transylvanian accent.
It's a big place. It's a big place.
The mummy's there like, my dry cleaning bills on all these rags. Oh.
Hey, guys, I'm the Wolfman, and it's been 3 days since I last brutally murdered someone.
Good job. Thanks, Wolfman. Thanks for speaking your truth.
So we've kind of skirted around it, but yeah, like, what is kind of the standout, I don't know, moments of Nicolas Cage in like his performance, like what are the things you particularly like, Daryl, in Cage's performance? Maybe some smaller moments, or
I think if we're talking about smaller moments, I think one, it's easy to overlook on like a first viewing, but the way he uses his voice, and like this voice, you know, it's this kind of weird Transylvanian academic Atlantic European undefinable accent. It's kind of like Tommy Wiseau's accent. You can't really place it. Yeah. You don't really know where he's from. But throughout the film, there's just like little things that he says. And I think when there's like the girl that he's seeing leaves him a voicemail and he's just sat at home and he's like, well, fuck you too, sister. And then and just like the little moments where he's in the office and he he's almost playing it like hungover in a way. And it's just these whimpering like, and like, cause I was thinking about this as well, because obviously it was a choice to use this voice, and it kind of, as I touched on it, it almost, and I'm kind of a risk to say this, gives him a pass in a way for the kind of atrocious things that he's doing, because he's just absurd. But if Nicolas Cage was like playing this with a normal voice, or any actor was playing with a normal voice, going Alva, it wouldn't be nearly as interesting and unnerving as it is. Mm-hmm. And I you know, one day, unfortunately, Nicolas Cage will pass, and I think there will be books dedicated to his acting and chapters dedicated and articles just trying to go frame by frame, breaking down Vampire's Kiss. And, you know, because he'd done the voice before, or similar, like Peggy Sue Got Married, and he's done similar things with his voice later on with like Deadfall and things like that, using it to like absurdist heights. But I think it's most notably here. What? And this is kind of a voice that I've used unironically without realizing. We've all recited the alphabet scene. Come on. we've all done it. And I still do. It's part of my podcast theme tune, courtesy of Petros Betzilivas. So it will see me to the grave, that voice and alphabet. And I'm a better man for it.
He wheels that accent out in Color Out of Space as well. And like, what's quite unnerving is is he says that, that's kind of how his dad spoke. Like he had this kind of academic transatlantic accent because he was trying to sound a bit more like, I don't know, like holier than thou than he was. It's just kind of like really, really fascinating that like, what does that say about his dad? Do you know what I mean? That he's like, oh yeah, there's this despicable character I'm playing. Oh yeah, I'm using dad's voice.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, it's interesting though, because it's like, it's such a choice to use that accent, and what accent is it anyway? It's a bizarre one. And the thing is, like, being an American here in the UK, I feel like I do hear people that are American sometimes or from Canada who have been here a long time, and you hear them drop weird little lines here and there that feel like it sounds like this, and it is that, I guess, that transatlantic thing, and it doesn't make sense. But guys, there's a moment in the film towards, I think towards the end, when he's talking to his fake new potential girlfriend, and he says he's from Philadelphia, but he's lived in New York for like 10 years.
Yeah.
And being someone who's from America, I lived in Philadelphia for a while, and I was just like, this guy's not from Philly. But I did a little bit of research, and there is a Philadelphia in Tyne-and-Wear here in England.
There we go.
So maybe that explains the accent.
There we go. I'm surprised the American one's not called New Philadelphia, as they seem to like seem to do with a lot of places. Yeah, just put new one. No, just put new one in the beginning. It's New York, baby. It's not York. What moments stick out for you, Jonathan, in this, like with Cage's performance?
God, it's really the overall like evolution or de-evolution into the vampire state. Like, mm-hmm. I already said kind of at the top about how it feels like he goes from, you know, being at the top of the totem pole, which he even sort of gladly uses those lines on Alva about her being at the bottom of the totem pole, to basically being like a homeless man in the street talking to himself, like with a fucking huge plank of wood, mm-hmm. AKA stake. And I mean, that's like on the surface there, but it's like literally like throughout the film. And that's the sort of stuff I was talking about when I was thinking there's a lot more here under the level of like what Nicolas Cage is kind of actually giving you. If you just look at his face, how he just, like, I don't know what he does. He evolves throughout the film, where he goes from being like, you know, like I said, someone who looks like he could be hanging out with Patrick Bateman to like a like orc, like mm-hmm. his face. Like, how does he make himself look so ugly? Like towards the end of the film, like his nose looks like 50 times bigger. His eyes look like, you know, way more sunken into a skull. His hair is just
hair.
Longer and disheveled. Yeah. And like, it doesn't make sense. Like, he just looks like almost like a thin penguin from, you know, Tim Burton's Batman. You know, it's like strange. And his eyes, just the way they move around and stuff. I mean, I know he's really riffing off the German expressionism of, you know, like we've already said, like Count Orlok or whatever from Nosferatu and stuff, but like, it's insane just watching his face. Like, that's the most impressive thing I think about this performance.
There's that moment when he comes out of his office, when Alva like knocks on the door with the contract, and like he's kind of got almost like a devil lock, like, do you know what I mean? Like, it looks like a misfit, hanging down his face, and like the shoulders are up super high, and he's like, he starts, and it's the physicality, isn't it? Because he starts going, too late, like kind of like tick-tocking his head back and forth, and it's like, it's such a physical performance. And like, I think a moment that really stands out for me is really small, is when he jumps onto that desk and he's like, there you are. And it's like, that's some physical prowess there. And it kind of like, that is a moment unto itself, where you go like, he's not half-assed in this. Like, he's going all in for it. And I think on set they said he just did that and kind of took people by surprise when he did it. Like, Robert Bierman was like, yeah, do that. Like, let's do that. From all sounds as well, it kind of sounds like, Robert Bierman had had this to say about the film.
So nobody really understands what this movie is about.
Which is probably good. Well, I'm a big believer in the ambiguous and letting it be about whatever people want it to be about. But I always saw the movie as a story of a man whose loneliness and inability to find love literally drives him insane.
Yeah, and he said like nobody. He said in another clip somewhere that nobody knew what they were really doing. Like this was like a totally non-union picture, and I think like in that scene where he comes out of the club with Jackie and he's trying to hail a cab, there's actually like when they're trying to film that, there's people with bullhorns there, like union people, like giving them shit, basically being like, fuck you for like for doing this outside of the union, like kind of like. And a lot of the later scenes of him like in the street like accosting people, it's just Cage just like wandering the streets and then the camera just at a distance. And like, I think it speaks to that time in New York, because like that is what people saw on the streets. Like it kind of, and I think, yeah, we were talking off air about, there's a great Ringer piece by Zach Sonfeld who kind of talks about, he says he meets up with Joseph Minion in New York and it's like, the New York of today isn't the New York of this movie. And it's kind of like it was a more darker, I don't know, people, mimes slapping each other in the face kind of place than the kind of sanitized brunch. Do you know what I mean? Like, getting coffees to go kind of place it is today.
I mean, you really start with and end with the New York skyline, which is always like a choice of New York films. I feel like, especially of this time in the 90s, it felt very like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles coming in on the city. Or what's the other? So I Married an Axe Murderer, I think, has a similar sort of thing. But like, you know, it just feels like a interesting sort of like New York is a character in this movie just as much as like, you know, anybody else is in this film. And like, you really can't get films like that these days with like, I mean, you could, but like New York is like so different now. This like sort of the 90s was like the last time. I mean, I guess it's even like the mid 90s was like where film really started to change with technology and stuff as well. And CGI became more of a thing and just films started to just look different. But like this film still looks like that, like gritty, you know, New York of the 70s, like even though it's not in the 70s at all, but like it has that quality and it's just really interesting. And like to a point where even like the end of the fucking movie is like fucking Taxi Driver. Like, mm-hmm, you know, he like is stabbed and then the camera just floats up in the air and it's like, that's one of the most famous New York films ever. So like, you know, it's just like totally riffing off of that.
Mm. It's really fascinating because it does have that, like you say, there's that bleakness of the 70s, but the excess of the 80s. It feels very much like a film out of its time. It feels too late and too early at the same time.
Yeah.
Like the way that American Psycho looks back at the 80s excess and goes like, wasn't that fucking mental? Or like, and it's kind of like a bit too late and like, oh, we're going to make this super bleak. And it's like, oh no, we've moved past that. It's all kind of like Duran Duran and Good Times now. Like we've left, do you know what I mean? We've left moody men in the 70s. Like,
and like to even like use a movie to criticize those kind of men is more of a thing of now, I feel something. Like.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it also gives you a whole nother time frame that this movie could have been from.
100%.
Yeah, I think that's what is. Yeah, I feel like that's what's like really kind of. I think newer, younger audiences who probably were drawn in from the meme culture of it, like who just decide to actually watch it, probably find it pretty profound in today's time, because it's like, you know, at the time when it came out, it was totally slept on, and people weren't ready for those conversations because, like, you know, the dickhead bosses hadn't been told, hey, you know, that behavior you do isn't cool. Like, they haven't been told that yet. So it's like people weren't on board to, like, stick it to the man yet.
Oh, yeah. They're all watching Wall Street like it's an aspirational movie. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, baby. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, we're getting now. We're getting like the Wolf of Wall Street, which like if you kind of like peel back the layers of the kind of excess of that movie, is kind of going, all these people are fucking horrible. Do you know what I mean? It kind of sits in the pantheon with that, but just it's just crazy that it kind of came out in the maelstrom of all of that. And a film that's like kind of not really about that as well. Joseph Minion kind of said it's basically about like the breakup of his relationship and kind of being in like a kind of almost like vampiric relationship with his then partner as a producer on this film, who they kind of like were just sucking the life out of each other. And like,
Which I found was interesting because I read that same Ringer article and there was a bit where it was saying that at one point the producers had toyed with the idea of making the vampire and Alva the same person, like the same actor. And I think that would have been fucking brilliant. Like that was actually something that's kind of missing from this. Cause like it would have, I mean, it like at the same time, you're kind of like, I don't really know what's real here anyway. So it wouldn't have really taken away from anything, in my opinion. Like it would have only added more substance to like the two just taking energy away from each other, you know?
100%. So is there any other like aspects of the films anyone wants to kind of shine a light on? I've got a few things here on the list that I wanted to delve into, but I'll just leave out sort of David. What kind of obviously
I was looking at when this film came out as well, like June 1989. Obviously there's a few years delay on it, but I was just looking on Box Office Mojo for the films that were released in June 1989, and you've got Dead Poets Society, Star Trek V, Ghostbusters 2, Batman, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, The Karate Kid 1. This film didn't stand a chance. I mean, what a choice to release this in June. I just find it fascinating. Like, obviously, it was put on the shelf for whatever reason it was put on the shelf. But if you're releasing it at the same time as, you know, the first Michael Keaton Batman, then what are you thinking? Yeah. What is going on?
I think they
also kind of just like not knowing the. sorry, I was gonna say. It also kind of like feels like not knowing the history. If you like, you know, if you don't know the history of like the release and the issues with like funding and trying to get it, you know, distributed like that. It feels like it's almost an answer for Nick Cage to kind of be like, oh, I should have been cast as Batman, so I'm going to do my own fucking weird like version of Batman, you know? Like, so I feel like when I did a Batman episode, he was a name that kind of came up. Like, I know he's famously attached to the Superman from Tim Burton, but like, I feel like he was a name that was pitched around and toyed around for Batman.
Which would have been... would have been fascinating. I think he obviously got to kind of live that dream by channeling it in Kick-Ass, right? The kind of Adam West style Batman. And I think they put it down to the fact that Batman was released at the same time for this movie's failure, which I think is so bizarre. Like, do you know what I mean? This is counter-programming of the highest order. Like if they seriously thought that, I don't know, people are that dumb to go, oh, there's a vampire film and there's a Batman film, like they're gonna go, well, it's only one bat related movie I'm gonna see this weekend. Like, it kind of feels like they weren't in competition with each other whatsoever.
Yeah, absolutely not. I mean, it's just like, this isn't a film you want to release in the middle of summer though as well. So
they were putting a lot of hope on this movie doing really, really well. And the fact it was released sort of post Moonstruck for Cage as well, and I think he'd had a Golden Globe nomination for Moonstruck, didn't like the powers that be tell him like not to do this movie, and then he dropped out and then he's like, no, actually I want back in. I need Vampire's Kiss in my repertoire.
Yeah, I think he dropped out because Joseph Minion dropped out from being the director. And like, I think he was the one who like talked him into doing the film, because he wrote the film and he was going to direct it, and then was just like, "Nah, I can't do this. I mean, it's literally about my breakup. I can't be in the same room with the who was the producer, his ex." So he decided to drop out, and then Cage was like, whoa, like, who's this Bierman guy? And he leaves, but then was secretly, you know, calling up probably and just like, oh, I really want to do this movie. I can't stop thinking about it. Alva.
So, David, is there anything that you'd like to kind of shine a light on in this film that we haven't mentioned as of yet?
I mean, I feel like you guys have really touched on a lot of it, and there's been a lot of the same points that I maybe would have had. So, I mean, the only other thing I would say is, like, haven't you guys, like, gone a little crazy when you can't find, like, a piece of paper that you, like, knew should have been filed somewhere and it's just not there? Like, I mean, feel like that's a universal feeling, really, yeah. You know?
Yeah, I love the scene where he's, like, explaining the whole thing about filing, because, like, it's like he's not wrong at all, but at the same time, it's coming from such an entitled place where it's like, dude, like, you know exactly, like, what that means to be misfiled. It's in the fucking title of the word. It's like, why are you acting like you've never heard of this before?
What do you mean? You just put it in.
It never just goes away.
Although
the Peter highs and the Peter lows of filing.
Yeah. I do question, though, like, had Alva not misheard what he said? Because he clearly did say at the very beginning of the film, Alva, I've checked this folder, I checked under this folder, like, what was it, Waterman, and I checked under something else, and then he's just like, but I need you to look at the Der Spiegel folders.
Yeah.
And she goes to check the Waterman folder and the other folder that he had mentioned, but she didn't check the Der Spiegel. And that was, I mean, I get that it's like so relatable, the workplace bullshit in this film, right? Like, you know, because like everybody's been there before, like someone's like misheard your boss saying something and you go and do something and it's like totally wrong and it's not what your boss asked for.
Mm-hmm. Or Jonathan, his team, Peter Lowe, did nothing wrong.
My question was, I wonder if that's what set him off. Like, had she found the document, or had she actually checked the Der Spiegel, you know, folders, she probably still wouldn't have been able to find it. But like, what was it? What was it that like tipped him over the edge? What? Because like, you know, you don't want to like completely fall into the whole like vampire thing, because that's a bit silly. But maybe it's like he's too sexually active and stuff, and is like, you know, picked up some sort of like, I don't know, disease or something. Because there's something going on with this man, and he hit a tipping point, and it's like hard to see why he's taking it out on Alva. Like, whoa. I can't buy into the whole like love thing, because like that's silly.
Yeah, it could just be this whole film is him on a mescaline trip, right? He does say like,
he does bring that up.
Like, which would make a lot of sense, like, for this whole film. Like, there's a kind of overarching question on this film, and I like your opinions on it. Does all of it happen? Does some of it happen? And if so, what happens? What doesn't happen? Daryl, for you, like, what are the definite articles that does happen?
Yeah, there's definitely a vibe of like Peter Lowe is an unreliable narrator in this. So it's
oh yeah,
just a little bit. I mean, you question, is the therapist real? You question, is the vampire mistress real? Because there's that whole scene in the nightclub where he confronts her, but then she suddenly then doesn't know who he is and she's with someone else, but then she's also kind of smiling. And then there's that kind of scene at the credits. She's like, dream of me, my angel. So I feel like maybe two of the therapist scenes actually happened, but I feel like most of this, like, I feel like he actually chased a pigeon. I feel like that was real. I feel like he maybe actually brought some vampire teeth. There's the taxi driver as well. Is the taxi driver real? Because he sees a hallucination of him and his wife.
Oh, yeah.
His office at one point as well.
Yeah.
So it all happened and none of it happened is my answer. I have no idea. I have no idea. And that's why it will stand the test of time.
What about you, David? Is there some things that like you're like, that is concrete, that actually happened?
Yeah, that exactly like Daryl was just saying. It there's enough like little tricks in there to kind of make it where you really can't trust anything. And I was left at the end thinking maybe the therapist scenes are all fake. And then I was thinking, you know, there's so many other things that could be, especially if those really are, but then maybe they are real and it's just the last one. That maybe once he's already like, you know, gone to his bottom, he just like, he just has no, you know, no grip anymore. But yeah, you just can't know. And Cage was saying in that one interview that you played that, you know, he loves these kind of like open-ended kind of question movies. And I love that too. And that's part of what I loved about the movie.
What about you, Jonathan? So like, what 100% is concrete in this?
That he is a piece of shit. I do want to bring up the Alva stuff with her and her home life. Mm-hmm. Like, I question if any of that's actually real, because it's very bizarre. Like, she clearly looks like she's like maybe in her 30s. You know, pushing 30, if not already, like, yet she's like a fucking child at home with her brother, who is also like an adult man living at home with his parents, which, I mean, they're in New York City, so maybe, and, you know,
culturally as well.
Culturally as well, yeah, like maybe they live with their family and stuff, but it's the fact that she's like wearing these like little white 90s and everything that she wears to like, to work, like looks like a little girl's dress and stuff. And I know it's also the 80s, so it's like, you know, you have to take that into account, but it's just bizarre, like the whole thing, the way, you know, she goes into her brother's room and he's like consoling her and he's like, what's wrong baby. It's just like, it's really weird, like, and like not enough people talk about like that side of the film, I feel like, because you really have, you know, hey, like Cage going insane in this film, but like, man, it's like weird characters that are surrounding him all around that really drive the story.
Yeah, I think for me, the only character who like feels normal whatsoever is Jackie, who played by Cassie Lemons. So he's like, is kind of like the scorned like date he has. He's like, he just keeps fucking around, basically. Like him and maybe like her and maybe like the little boy who lives downstairs, who like, I think you get a glimpse of, like, you kind of like really wants to see in on the action, doesn't he? Kind of sees Peter Lowe dragging a woman upstairs, like, whoa. Like, let's have a,
and then she comes out naked screaming like, but also laughing.
It's that Alva stuff is fascinating. Like, there's that moment like when she goes to see her brother at the gas station as well, and he's like going, you don't put actual bullets in the gun, you'll blow someone's head off with that, like, kind of thing. You just use blanks. And I'm not sure about like the science on this, but when Peter Lowe fires the blanks in his mouth, that would still hurt, right?
I feel like it would, like,
at least burn, maybe?
Yeah, you're blowing a cartridge out at least anyway, right? Like, it.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that close range, you would definitely do some damage. It's not like it's a cap gun, you know? Like, so I don't really understand.
Yeah, it's presented as a cap gun.
Yeah.
But I think we're supposed to believe she's firing blanks because her brother's against having actual bullets. But it just gives us classic Nicolas Cage screaming the word boo-hoo instead of crying. So it's not all bad.
I was so like floored by what was going on throughout most of the film that like it felt kind of par for the course for him saying boo-hoo. And it was only until after I was like done watching him, I was like, did he say boo-hoo? Like,
he just watching with boo-hoo. Subtitles what? On and it said boo-hoo and I just started cracking up.
Like. Yeah. I mean, same for me, but like subtitles are really unreliable at times as well. So I was just like, you know, but... Yeah.
Is that like the final topper for him in the confirmation that he's a vampire? Because I think he's gone into like, he can't see himself in the mirror. He's like, oh my God, where am I? Oh. And then he shoots himself and he doesn't die. And then I think he's screaming, I'm a vampire. Yeah.
Like that
is just fascinating.
The final like 45 minutes of this are like a proper just free fall into madness as well, right? It's kind of like, from when he like assaults Alva, like, and he has that boo-hoo moment. From then, it's kind of like no holes bars, absolute batshittery. And I love, like, but there's like, I love the kind of peppered moments of comedy in it, like when he's going to buy the fangs and the guy's like, oh yeah, we've got these fiberglass ones, they're really good, they'll cost you like $45. And he's like, well, we got these cheap ones. He's like, $3.50. He's like, I'll take the cheap ones, please.
It's like he's not leaving there without the teeth, you know, he has to have the teeth.
Yeah. Didn't he have like no money from the cab to go and see Alva as well, or something like that?
Well,
that,
like, you cleared me out, Alva. You cleared.
And I will say as well,
$50 to get you home.
Side note: no one retches on screen like Nicolas Cage.
Oh yeah,
no one's doing it like him. It's obviously just that whole like, oh, you put it in the right file. It's just like, are you okay, Peter? Shut up, bitch. And then at the end, he's having the argument with his imaginary girlfriend, and then like the hair's flopping and and scuttering under that like coffin sofa. He's got a great scutter as well, the best scutter.
The coffin sofa is amazing. Like, it's awesome. It's so like, you know, you're, I don't know, like 4 years old and building like a pillow fort, you know, yeah, or something, you know, it's amazing. Just flip your couch over, a couple pillows, that's you done. So good. I mean, the ending's tremendous as well, mm-hmm, to be honest, like opening the coffin, the sofa coffin. Yeah.
So good. Oh, there are so many kind of small little moments I love in this, whether it's like the two mimes slapping each other in the face. There's a moment when he's on the phone, and there's like, the thing is, for like Robert Bierman kind of saying that it kind of all feels like it was like flying by the seat of their pants, like kind of getting all this together. It's really like accomplished and put together really well, like the use of like kind of the angles of the shots and stuff like that. And as you've like mentioned before, there's shots that ape like old classic kind of Nosferatu or that era of like Hollywood cinema. But yeah, there's just like these bizarre little touches. Like when he's on the phone, I think he calls his therapist and then calls Jackie to say like, do you want to meet up tonight? There's a guy who just walks out in a Robin Hood hat. Like a little, yes, like, or yeah, like there's just some like,
I noticed that,
some bald guy just sat there like for the whole time. Or I particularly love, yeah, like small performances from people who just like pop up in this. There's the woman in the bathroom when Peter like chases Alva, and she's like, I think she's like, yeah, she's just like, what the fuck is going on? Like, and then like you see her like comforting Alva afterwards. It's like so much of this, like, I think I'm with you guys where I just question everything, even down to the fact, like, do literary agents get paid this much money? Like, do you know what I mean? He's kind of like a man about town, out every night, seems to have like, I don't know, he hasn't got the nicest apartment, like, but like, do you know what I mean? He's at least not sharing in New York City. Like, he kind of like looks like, yeah, he lives in a nice building.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like he's, I don't know, he's either like does have, or maybe he doesn't. Maybe he's not as like flesh as like you would think he is. Maybe he lives beyond his means, and that's like another part of his problem. Because if you are like, you know, unable to buy the fiberglass, you know, teeth, which I definitely would have loved to have seen because it would have really looked goofy. but also just like complaining about, you know, 50 quid of a like taxi fare and stuff, you know, he's, I don't know, it's sort of like an interesting question, because he could be either like a total, like, you know, just adding into his toxicity of his, like, you know, being this stupid boss who's like just a cheapskate, or he's like not really as rich as he like makes himself seem, which is sort of like a time, like a sign of those times of people who were like living beyond their means and flashing all this wealth that they actually didn't really have, because it's like just all status symbols.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that would fit really well with that, you know, those kinds of toxic people do tend to kind of puff their chest up a lot and, you know, act like they're, you know, bigger shots than they actually are.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know we sort of touched on it earlier, and I think whether you sort of want to admit it or not, Peter Lowe is the precursor to Patrick Bateman. Like he just is. And it's kind of, you know, we talk about unreliable narrators and he's, you know, is he wealthy? Is he not? But, and obviously it depends on how much you believe that this film is actually happening or not. But from the first scenes, like he is successful with women, bafflingly enough. It makes no sense.
He's the top shagger. Yeah. He's absolute like diner. Yeah, he's out every night picking up different chicks, listening to ESG in the club. Yeah. Like,
yeah.
See, it's incredible considering, and this is me gesturing to all of Peter Lowe, because like he comes in like that sort of like floppy sort of thin hair, sort of like those weird suits, that voice, but he's charming still and he's still successful and he's bringing sort of ladies home. And, you know, obviously that first scene is kind of, you kind of pick your head around like, who is Peter Lowe? Who is this guy? You know, and then he's obviously got the whole first scene with him jousting with the bat, which I think is another great scene as well. The bat cam especially is amazing. And I think I'd read something, someone that apparently wanted a real bat, but the director had to talk him out of it because there was a risk of him actually dying and that would ruin the film.
yeah. Get rabies or like, yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of like.
Was this something as well that he, at this point, he'd insisted for lovemaking scenes that he had hot yogurt dripped on his toes?
Yeah,
as well?
I read something about that as well. It's like, what? Like, so those scenes where he's being, I don't know, attended to, sucked on by the maybe real, maybe fake vampire was, they wouldn't show his feet. So if you watch that those scenes again, they're not showing his feet because apparently they're being, covered in hot yogurt.
Understanding.
Bizarre.
I think this film is like, it's not without its kind of, not controversies, but kind of like, I think Cage's behavior, I think Jennifer Bills has kind of gone on record saying like he was, for her, was quite unbearable. Because I think this was at a time when he probably was kind of like flirting with the method and stuff like that and kind of like being very much in character a lot of the time and obviously towards her character and like a lot of the characters are just quite insufferable. So like, I can imagine.
I did read something about that where he had like, he wasn't a fan of her and I was just sort of wondering why. And then it was also like how he maybe wanted, I think his girlfriend at the time, Patricia Arquette, to be the vampire, but she was so like too little of a name and Jennifer Bills had just done Flashdance. So it was sort of like, we need a name to help sell this film, like to go along with you. And that was like, I guess like a stickling point. And I don't know if there was someone else like where they were supposed to do it and they had to drop out at the last minute, but he preferred that person over Jennifer Bills. And it was this weird sort of toxic relationship between the two.
Well, there's some weird casting what ifs with this film. So Judd Nelson was approached to do the part of Peter Lowe as, and I think signed on till like quite late in the process was Dennis Quaid. Who decided to take Inner Space as opposed to this film. Like, and I guess, we wouldn't have Jack Quaid if it wasn't for Inner Space. So I guess Dennis Quaid is happy with the choice he made.
Sure.
So, I guess that's about it for Vampire's Kiss. But before I let you guys out into the night to do whatever you want to do, whether it is to go boogie to some ESG, whether you want to, I don't know, accost people asking for them to end your life and drive a stake into your heart.
Yeah.
I guess, we've looked at the kind of the early point of Nicolas Cage as a kind of a horror character, or at least flirting with the idea of horror. What would you guys like to see in the future for Nicolas Cage in the kind of horror space? Is there a particular like subgenre you'd like to see him play about in, a particular director? Obviously we're getting something at least horror adjacent next year with Renfield, where once again he gets to don the fangs and be a bloodsucker playing Dracula. And I believe you might be able to corroborate this, Daryl. He's kind of brought back the Peter Lowe voice for his Dracula, right?
Yeah, it seems like he's bringing it back to an extent, because he's definitely mentioned it in an interview, sort of his father inspiring it. So, you know, Peter Lowe never truly dies. He will live in our unstaked hearts forevermore, and I hope he does. Until the inevitable day those cowards bring this movie out on Blu-ray in the UK as well.
So, yeah, Daryl, is there a particular director or place in horror you'd like to see Cage moving into in the future?
Oh, well, I mean, obviously we said we've got Dracula coming, very excited for that. I was sort of thinking about this because obviously he did that interview and he was talking about a number of directors he'd like to work with, but I think for me, one he didn't mention, but I think together they could make something incredible would be working with Sam Raimi. I think they could do some wonderful things together. Now, what that would be, I don't know. Just for shits and giggles, remake The Evil Dead, but cast Nicolas Cage as Ash Williams, just for a laugh and see what happens. But I just want to put you two in a room, just talk it out, whatever you come up with. I'll start that Kickstarter, I'll start that GoFundMe, and I'm here for it.
Oh, if they said Ash Williams had like a long-lost brother and it was Nicolas Cage, yes, please. Any day of the week, a Buddy Road horror comedy with those two would be an absolute
give delight. Me Cage and Bruce Campbell and Sam Raimi and just let it happen, please.
Sounds wonderful.
Have those two ever been in the same room? Because if they do, I think it would be like the final days moment that would bring upon the end of the world. Bruce Campbell and Nicolas Cage. Jonathan, is there a particular director or kind of subgenre you'd like to see Cage tackle?
I feel like I've said this before on your podcast, and I feel like, you know, why not just say it again? I'd love for him to do something with the Safety brothers and get into like just sort of like a gritty thriller sort of thing. Something to keep you like, you know, heart race, and, you know, give him a little bit of love, like, you know, Adam Sandler got. I mean, but I think when I first said that, I think that was pre, like, you know, Cage having a bit of a moment recently with Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. So, I don't know, keep that train going. That'd be interesting. Like, just do something. It doesn't necessarily need to be horror, but, like, you know, sort of like thriller-esque, you know, you can really touch on his acting abilities.
And the Safdie brothers basically make horror movies anyway. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Uncut Gems is like a real world horror movie. Like,
It's like, it's a lot more realistic, you know, and like dealing with the actual choices that people make rather than like, you know, something that you had a dream about or something. So
yeah. Social anxiety movies.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could almost see the Safdie brothers version of this film that kind of strips away all of the vampire stuff. Just this guy kind of living this excess lifestyle. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a New York movie. Yeah, that's got to happen, right? I think he's edging ever closer. He's kind of, I think he's slated, he's filming right now, I believe, his first movie for A24. So, like, he kind of feels like he's creeping towards their direction. What about you, Dave? Is there any particular like place in horror you'd like to see him work in, or director you'd like to see him work with?
I was gonna say Robert Eggers, but since we've already covered the A24 base, let's go James Wan and put him in Malignant 2. Oh.
Get Cage to throw a chair.
I would have just totally like lost my shit if, you know, they opened up the back of her head and it was actually Nick Cage's face. Like, screaming.
Release the Cage cut.
Doing that retching. Yeah.
Yes. Doing that face when he's telling Alva she's nothing as well. You like the big eyes. Like, that would be perfect.
He parkours through a skyline going, "It never just goes away."
Too late, too late, too late. Too late. Amazing. So, what is this a recommend from everyone? Is it safe to say it's a recommend, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Stop looking at the memes and just sit down and actually watch it.
Yes.
So, seeing as, you, Jonathan, and you, David, like, this kind of, like, first time watch for you, David, and kind of like pretty much first time watch for you.
Yeah.
Will this become a Halloween staple for you in the future?
I mean, I can't wait to watch it again. Like I said, especially with the whole what's real and what's not real aspects of this, like I can't wait to like see where things solidify for me in multiple viewings. I'm very much looking forward to watching it again, maybe before next Halloween.
Nice. What about you, John?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it would necessarily become a Halloween staple, but I will definitely like be willing and up for watching it again and trying to recommend it to people probably if they haven't seen it. So for sure.
I saw recently there was an article like Criterion wrote about this. And like, I think they've like put it in their kind of on the Criterion channel in the US, have put it as a part of their like horror kind of programming, which seems that's kind of pretty great that it's kind of, I don't know, getting that mark of approval. What about you, Daryl? Is this a go-to every time October rolls around, or how often will you revisit this film going forward?
You think I'm going to limit this to October, you coward? No, like I said, I think I said this off record as well. The last times I've watched this, I think it has been admittedly through sort of a skewed comedic memeified viewing, and this was kind of the first time I just watched it straight as just a movie, and with everything we've discussed as well, I think it bears repeat viewings. There's a lot of layers to this, which there's just no way you can appreciate the different possible readings of this movie on like a first viewing. So it's not the first time I've seen this movie. It will not be the last. And it's something I've said before, you know, when you talk about the Nick Cage filmography, there are Nicolas Cage movies and movies with Nicolas Cage in. And this is the most Nicolas Cage movie of them all, like far exceeding like your Deadfalls and your Wicker Mans. And as you said, without this movie influencing him, you know, we really don't get the rest of his career. Like we don't get Face Off, for example. He's cited this movie as being very important. So I think for the Cage completionist, you've got to watch it. For the horror enthusiast, it's worth watching. For the curious mind out there, I think, you know, this is an hour and a half, an hour and 40 minutes. You owe it to yourself to see this film. I think it's going to be one of those, you know, I don't know if it's going to get a massive resurgence. Hopefully maybe we'll get the Blu-ray one day, but I think it's going to slowly but surely reappeal itself to cult viewings and sort of smaller screenings and like fun one-off screenings as well. So I just hope that more people see this because it's, and I don't want to overstate this, this is a very, very important film. This is our generation Citizen Kane, goddamn
it. Yes.
Which brings me on to a point. I had a look, Jonathan, and the Prince Charles Cinema have not screened this film since 2016. My only question is, what the fuck?
It's actually 2019.
Ah, shit. Shit, I got it wrong.
No, yeah, I mean, I think 2019 would have been it. And I know in the past, I think prior to my time, that we were doing, actually funny enough, double features with American Psycho, which is amazing. But, you know, it's one of those films that, like, I think it's like it slowly finds like an audience, and it's one of those things I feel like it hasn't quite found its place to be like, you know, a yearly staple in our Halloween program. And also I think we, you know, try to, especially the last couple of years, have tried to be a little bit more experimental with the Prince Charles Cinema and like throwing in, you know, new things. Cause I swear for like a good 6 years or so, it was like almost like carbon copy every year of the program. And it's like this year and last year has been really interesting of like a mix of different horror films that you've never seen before. Feels like the flavor this year is like teen horror films from like the turn of the millennium, which is kind of like a nice thing to see. But maybe, you know, next year will be the year that this film finds its way back into the program.
Well, there's talking of the amazing program there, I got to point out the fact that I absolutely love that you've listed Shiver Baby in your as a horror movie and a part of the horror programming for the Rich Charles. It's amazing.
Yeah, definitely. It's just like one of those just weird, hey, it's, you know, sort of horrific in a way, going home and having to deal with people in your, you know, hometown.
Amazing. Well, guys, thank you so much for coming and getting spooky with me and talking about Vampire's Kiss. Daryl, where can people find you online if they wish to do so?
Well, I'm usually quite active on the old Twitter machine at @cage_podcast. I think like Petros at this moment in time, I've watched all the Nicolas Cage movies. We're all caught up. Cage Rage, a Nicolas Cage podcast, if you want to go back and listen to my efforts. And then eventually it is coming. Myself and Petros will be teaming up to cover the works of Willem Dafoe, Getting Dafoe You, Willem Dafoe podcast. It is coming. We're just both... I'm just usually busy with the real life. It is coming, I promise you.
What about yourself, David? Where could people find you and your amazing podcast?
People can find Piecing It Together wherever they listen to podcasts. And of course, I'm on Twitter at @PiecingPod, and our website is piecingpod.com. And you can find both Daryl and Petros on some episodes of that. And yeah, hopefully people check it out.
Yeah, it's a lovely time. What about you, Jonathan? Obviously, yeah, you're still churning out the Pod Charles Cinecast, which is an absolute joy to listen to. Where can people listen to that and find you online?
Yeah, well, like you said, it's the Pod Charles Cinecast. That's everywhere you get your podcasts on any of those machines that let you listen to podcasts. Yeah, so it's the weekly podcast of the Prince Charles Cinema, but we've kind of lost our shit over the last couple years and just became whatever the hell we feel like doing. Yeah, it's silly. If you want silly arcs of just madness of us just figuring out like dumb ways we can take our brains to watch really silly movies and then occasionally decide to act out the movies that we're supposed to be talking about or not even covering the films we're supposed to be talking about and just talking about fashion or something, then you can head over to at the PCC podcast on Twitter or Instagram. Give us a follow, find your links to listen to it. And me personally, I am at Tall for All, T-A-L-L, the number 4, A-L-L, on Twitter and Instagram, and I play some music. So I might try to release an album soon. We also, Petros and I, like, are apparently Breadcrumbs Collective. So, yeah, I also do that as well. I kind of started that and invited Petros over to be a part of the Breadcrumbs Collective, which is just a goofy, like, family podcast. I need to be more proactive with that. But, you know, life and things.
Yeah. We all need to be hard. More proactive with so much stuff. Like, I ask people to join a Patreon every week that... I haven't put anything out on in ages because it's like trying to juggle this podcast, having a life, having a child, and then a second podcast. It's like knowing how many, do you know what I mean? Knowing how many people sign up to the are on the Patreon. It's like, oh yeah, I feel bad that I'm not giving them stuff, and why would more people want to come for like, I don't know, 10 episodes of a show? But yeah. Now I'm going to go out into the night with self-doubt. Thank you for that, Jonathan. Another thank you to you guys for coming and talking about Vampire's Kiss with me.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Pleasure, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
So there we have it, guys. Vampire's Kiss, getting you in that extra spooky mood. Thank you so much for listening, and a massive thank you once again to the fantastic Jonathan Foster, David Rosen, and Daryl Edge for joining me at what was really, really short notice. The guest who was lined up to be on the episode that was meant to drop today just couldn't make it. We all have life sometimes. Life sometimes gets in the way. And we can't do these things. And yeah, these guys, I thought, you know what? What better time to talk about Vampire's Kiss than as we approach the spooky season? If you haven't seen this film, you've got no excuse, really, if you live here in the UK. You can watch it on Freevee via Amazon Prime. It's with ads, but sometimes they just forget to really put them in. They're not that intrusive. It's not like watching them on a Tubi or something where they're kind of every like 4 or 5 minutes. This is like, hey, yeah, have an ad like half hour in or whatever. It'll be fine. It gives you a little pee break. You'll be fine. We're all getting old. We all need that time. We all need to re-up. We'll need to call our therapist, or We need to look on Amazon for some vampire teeth. Budget as well. We don't want those fiberglass £45 ones. We want those £3.50. As for next week, we're keeping it extra spooktacular here on Caged In. We revisit the Coppola family with the 1992 Francis Ford Coppola, Bram Stoker's Dracula. I will be joined by James Rodriguez to discuss that. A film that has just hit its 30th anniversary. Oh boy. I caught this at the cinema a couple of weeks back, and I am excited to chat about this one. I hope you are as well. I feel like this film has very much had a reevaluation over the years. And be sure to join me and James next week as we discuss Bram Stoker's Dracula. Dracula. So, if you'd like to support this podcast and give me some money, as I said in the end of that things, yeah, I'm really bad at the moment with doing the Patreon. I will get better, I assure you. More of you sign up to it, more of you can guilt me into it and go like, where's our extra content? And I'll do it. Or maybe I should do the extra content and then people will come. What is it they say? Make it and they will come. So yeah, maybe I need to live by that rules instead of just feeling guilt that people are paying for something, like masses and masses of people. At the moment, I should feel guilt because there are still people paying me each month. I'm still not delivering them content, which I am so sorry for, guys. I will get back around to it. I just need to pull my finger out of my arse and start recording some more stuff. If you don't want to part with your money, which a lot of people don't, I totally understand that. You can head on over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you're listening to this right now. Leave a 5-star rating and review. That would be fantastic. Always remember with your 5-star rating reviews on Apple Podcasts as well to let me know what you think, Bill Murray, Sister Scarlett Johansson, at the end of Lost in Translation. Or let me know what your entry point is to the Coppola family, or what's your favourite Nicolas Cage film. I always love to know that information. So yeah, drop it in your review. Give me that 5-star review, guys. Come on. It brings the eyes, it brings the people, it brings the ears to this here podcast. And if I do say so myself, it's a pretty damn fine podcast at that. So yeah, lend me your fingers and thumbs, the tip-tap type away those reviews. So I guess that's all for this week. So I haven't had this outro in a little while, but I have been Petros Patsilivas. I've been Caged In. You've been amazing. Remember to keep it caged in, and I'll catch you next time.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.